A year ago yesterday, a Kenosha police officer shot Jacob Blake in the back 7 times following a 911 call. The shooting left Blake paralyzed. Here's his uncle, Justin Blake, talking about Jacob's condition today.
It's just a menagerie of pain. He can't even get out of the bed some days. I mean, it's not a good life any way you chop it up.
We're looking back at the Jacob Blake shooting, the civil unrest in Kenosha that followed, and where police reform efforts stand today in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you remember how you felt after you saw the video of the shooting? What memories do you have of the protest and unrest that came after in Kenosha? What changes do you want to see, if any, when it comes to policing in the state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Corrine Hess is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee. Corey, welcome back to the show.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Corey, can you tell us more about how Jacob Blake himself is doing a year after the shooting?
Well, as you just heard from his uncle, Justin, he's not doing well. Jacob is living in Chicago with family, and from talking to Justin, he needs around-the-clock care. He has a nurse with him most days. Otherwise, his family's taking care of him. He had a birthday party recently where he spent some time with his siblings, and Justin tells me that kept him bedridden for several days. Justin says Jacob's not doing very well.
And in your reporting, looking back over the last year, you also looked at the officer involved in this, Rustin Chesky, the Kenosha police officer who shot Blake. He was cleared of wrongdoing, I believe, by the department and by an outside investigation. Where is he now?
Yes, Rustin Chesky was cleared of any wrongdoing. So he was off the job for several months, and he was brought back to the department in April. And he's not back working on the street. I talked to the police chief who said, as of right now, he's not really sure what to do with him. Officer Chesky is working in the investigations unit, and they don't know what to do with him because his return caused quite a bit of controversy in Kenosha.
Can you talk some more about that response to that officer being back at work?
Yes. So, I mean, there's many people in the Kenosha community who feel that he doesn't deserve to continue to be a police officer. There's also people who think that he should have been arrested for the shooting, that he belongs, you know, in jail. So, I mean, just the fact that he's back working as a cop really caused a lot of trouble when he went back to work. Also, in talking to the Blake family, they told me that they were never alerted by the police department that Officer Chesky was coming back to work. So they were quite upset about that. The Blake family says that they're going to continue to fight until Officer Chesky loses his job, which, you know, of course, I don't know, you know, if that will ever happen, because Officer Chesky was not found guilty of any charges or charged.
You mentioned you talked to the police chief in Kenosha, Eric Larson. Mm-hmm. Here's a listen to some of what he said about the protests that followed the Jacob Blake shooting.
Oftentimes, as you see protests and all these things that have been going on for the last, you know, year and a half, well, really what it is it's the community expressing themselves.
What else did you hear from the Kenosha police chief about the relationship between his department and the community?
Well, this police chief, he's been with the department for 27 years. He was a deputy chief from 2016, just until recently. So I just want to make it clear, he wasn't a chief when all of this happened, but he had been with the department. So he was kind of interesting. He said that, you know, he always thought before the shooting that the department was really communicating well with the community. But what he has learned is that the department and the officers weren't really listening to the community. So what they've been trying to do is get out and doing more listening sessions, holding forums in the neighborhoods, not just pushing out notices on Facebook, but trying to get face to face with people. And so he believes that things are going better. In talking to the Blake family, they don't feel that way. But Chief Larson said that he feels like if there are more protests more rallies, things can be handled much differently than they were last summer.
Talking to WPR reporter Corey Hess, looking at Kenosha and the community and the people involved a year after the police shooting of Jacob Blake. And of course, the protests, Corey, some peaceful protests and rallies, some turned to rioting and destruction and the images of parts of the city very, very damaged, some buildings destroyed. What do those areas of the city look like now?
Well, a lot of it has been cleaned up. Downtown looks better than it had. And then the uptown neighborhood, which was really destroyed, there are plans to spend millions of dollars to put in some apartments, a hotel, some shops. But that's all still in the works. So the city has come forward with a plan, and they are working on some revitalization in that uptown neighborhood.
And another ongoing story, of course, the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, charged with multiple felony counts for the shooting of protesters, two of them fatally. Where does that trial stand now, Corey?
Well, of course, this trial was supposed to start in March, and it got pushed. So there is going to be a hearing in September just to go through some of the latest motions that have been made. And then the actual trial is supposed to start in November. So we'll see if that does happen.
And there's a new lawsuit, I understand, from the family of one of the victims Rittenhouse is charged in the homicide of. What's going on there?
Yes. Anthony Huber, who was allegedly killed by Kyle Rittenhouse, his family's filed a federal lawsuit against the Kenosha authorities, saying that they really incited the bloodshed by allowing Kyle Rittenhouse and other armed people to kind of wreak havoc and inflict injury during the unrest. So we'll see what happens with that. There's also another lawsuit that was filed last week, too. Not a lawsuit, but prosecutors want to be able to add in some other things during the trial. There's some video that showed Kyle Rittenhouse talking about wanting to kill and shoot and kill people just 2 weeks before what happened in Kenosha.
Corey, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for bringing us up to date.
Thank you.
That's Corinne Hess, WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. She was with us today to talk about the one-year anniversary of the shooting of Jacob Blake. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you think there's work that still needs to be done on criminal justice reform, on policing? Do you think we've seen any progress since the shooting of Jacob Blake or the murder of George Floyd? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation about the one-year anniversary of the shooting of Jacob Blake. You could join in with your thoughts, comments, or questions on policing in the year since, on community reactions. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Michael Bell joins us now. He's a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force. His son, Michael Bell Jr., was shot and killed by a Kenosha police officer almost 17 years ago. He's been working on police reform issues since then. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you for having me on your show, Rob.
I know stories like Jacob Blake's resonate with you, Michael, after your own experience. You've shared it on this show in the past, but can you remind us about your son and what happened to him?
Sure. I had a 21-year-old son. His name was Michael. And on November 9, 2004, he arrived in front of his own home, and an officer arrived shortly thereafter. You can go to the michaelbell.info, and you can see the dash cam. And Michael was grabbed by the neck and shoulder as an officer moved him out of view, and the officer accused Michael of running a stop sign and speeding. The officer later redacted those accusations in the federal civil rights trial. But to make a long story short, Michael refused the breathalyzer and started receiving kicks and knee strikes from the officers. He ended up running to the back of his house while he was handcuffed, and he was tased. And his mother and sister came downstairs, and a number of people that lived close by, they turned on their porch lights to watch him. And they actually saw Michael bent over a car in a bear hug. And at that point, an officer screamed, "He has my gun." And an officer came up and put his gun directly to my son's temple and killed him in front of his mother and sister. own investigators years later found out that the officer who screamed he has my gun had actually hooked it on a car mirror, and none of Michael's DNA or fingerprints were on the gun, and we have been claiming that there has been a cover-up ever since, and that's what we've been working on from day one. And in 2014, I spearheaded a team, and Wisconsin became the first state in the United States to require that all law enforcement-involved shootings be investigated by an outside team. And since then, that's been spread on to six different states.
Do you think that was enough, or are there other changes you've been hoping to see since then?
I don't think it was enough, but it was a very difficult one to accomplish. I'm a retired Air Force pilot, and I knew that we didn't investigate our own crashes by the people that trained them, and I didn't think that should happen in law enforcement. The people that investigated my son's death were the co-workers of the officers involved, and they essentially completed their investigation in just two short days, and they ruled themselves justified. There are other changes that need to occur, and I'll be glad to talk about them if you want.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask you about next. Are there changes you're hoping to see? And we've seen a few in Wisconsin just passed in the legislature. Where are we now since the shooting of Jacob Blake, since the death of course, George Floyd?
Well, first off, I live in Kenosha, and I saw the burnings. I did at least 40 interviews the week after Jacob was shot. But to go and that helped police reform here. A lot of things were minor, but we're looking at major systemic changes. And one of the changes that we've been working on, and I worked with Senator Van Wongar very closely on this, was a learning model based off the NTSB and how they look at airplane crashes, and they say what went wrong, and how do we prevent this from happening again? And so that legislation was created last year. It did not go into the session, but we have a number of people working on that, and that is just one of the changes that we're working on here in Wisconsin.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jackie is with us in Appleton. Jackie, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that as an individual who feels like I'm pretty much dead on in the middle, clearly kindness and respect are the answer, no matter what. I have a father and a stepmother who traveled to the Capitol in January, and I had to take space from them for a while because it was emotionally disturbing for me because I feel like they're so far on one side. I have a reverend from the Unitarian Universalist Church that I used to attend who I got into a conversation with, and I no longer go to the Unitarian Universalist Church because she basically was trying to encourage me to educate myself and understand why it's okay when you want to stand up for Black Lives Matter, that it's okay to light things on fire. I don't think that being violent, regardless of what side you are on, is ever going to be the answer. And if somebody wants to do that type of thing, they maybe need to, you know, punch their pillow or do a thousand jumping jacks. Find a different way to get that out. Don't take it to a public forum and spread it across where it can actually hurt other people and spread negative energy. I mean, if you're not going to be respectful and kind, then you need to sit down and calm yourself down for a minute.
Jackie, thanks for the call. Jackie worried about extremes, Michael, and it just reminds me, you as someone working on police reform issues, you mentioned earlier that outside investigation thing. You were on the show with the head of a group that represents police officers, Jim Palmer. You and he worked together on this, even though you're coming obviously from very different perspectives. Do we need more of that?
Absolutely. I testified at the task force on 21st century policing for President Obama. And I saw a lot of other union leads down there, and I knew that if those people were in Wisconsin, the reform that we had worked on would have never occurred. I worked shoulder to shoulder with the executive director of the police, the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, Jim Palmer. And as I was going in the legislator's office, he was going in the legislator's office. There's a great story online in Political called Crossing a Thin Blue Line, and it talked about how me, a reform advocate, and the president of a police union got together and worked on the nation's first legislation of that type. We have to work together. Regarding my son's death, I can assure you that the officer who screamed he has my gun and my son's death committed suicide in 2010. And that I talked with that father of that officer. I am aware that that officer had two young boys that grew up without a father. So we have to understand that there is pain on both sides, and that's why we need to seek legitimate reform.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Michael Bell. He's an activist on police reform issues. Lost his son in a police shooting in 2004. He's a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force. We're talking about policing and communities a day after the anniversary of the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha. Michael, do you have thoughts on how we could bring police departments and communities together to have better relationships to hopefully prevent these kind of conflicts from escalating to a shooting in the first place?
Well, I think the National Transportation Safety Board model is the ideal one. In my own son's death, we had discovered that an officer had hooked his gun on a car mirror, and it was the holster design that affected that. And if we would have looked at that and we could have came back and said, well, maybe we shouldn't design a holster that can be misinterpreted as somebody taking it. And so by looking at the root cause analysis of everything that happened, that is the way to go ahead and issue recommendations to help prevent it from happening again. Law enforcement agencies don't have to incorporate the recommendations, but they're there. And just like the National Transportation Safety Board might issue 150 recommendations in an airplane crash and only 70 of them are implemented, it still makes the process better for everyone. We need data so that way we can look to see if legislative reform is effective. When I first started, there was no database. You have no idea how many people were killed in the state of Wisconsin by a police-involved shooting. And so how can legislators look back and say, you know, we implemented reform, and police-involved deaths have actually gone down? We don't have that yet, and that's a process we're working on.
It seems, Michael, to me like it'd be hard for a lot of people to do what you have done here. Obviously, a lot of emotion involved in the loss of your son, and you're also looking for this kind of very systematic, detailed, as you say, air crash investigation-like approach. How would you encourage people in the midst of what can be very emotional confrontations, whether you're a community member, a family member, a police officer, to be able to take a step back and try to dig into those root causes?
I actually have a checklist. You know, pilots have checklists because they have to do so many things on board an aircraft. And even now, before I came on and talked with you, Rob, I kind of went over the checklist in my mind. And number one, I kind of lower my head and surrender and say, let that will be done, because I recognize that God loves all souls equally. And they love the person that was maybe killed by a police officer, or the police officer was killed by somebody else. And by taking those emotions out and recognizing the divinity in all people, that's the approach that I've taken. And sometimes it's hard. The officer who shot my son had written a book on how he killed him, and we filed a libel suit against that. But I did it in a very calm manner. I did it without emotions or hatred on it. I did it because the book actually libeled our family.
Michael, the checklist idea, I've seen police departments argue when it comes to use of force, we can't have checklist type guidelines. We can't have specific do this, don't do that guidelines, because every situation is unique and different. What do you think about the idea of departments creating specific use of force guidelines that are transparent and available for the public to see?
A checklist helps with some of the things that get you to the point. There's something in flying, it was called anticipatory training. Before I took off and pushed the throttles up to full throttle, I talked over with my co-pilot on what would happen if we had an emergency. Anticipatory training for law enforcement would be, let's talk about this before we arrive on scene. How are we going to handle that? And having a uniform set of standards set amongst everyone. Every situation is different. I wrote an article that was kind of a breakthrough article, and it's called you'll have to forgive me right now because I'm a little bit emotional about this topic, but it took the insanity of finding fault versus fixing cause, and I took two I took two accidents. I took an airplane accident that killed two people on a runway, and I took an accident where a boy down in Beaverton, Ohio, was shot by a police officer. And I lined them up side by side, and I show how one changed aviation forever and how the other one left law enforcement to repeat itself. And those two things, I think, are a good comparison on why we need to move in this new direction.
Do you see, in our last minute, Michael, do you see an openness to taking that kind of approach to learn from situations like the shooting in Ohio you mentioned, like the shooting of Jacob Blake, and do a little better, maybe a lot better in the future?
I do see an openness. I think what happened with Jacob Blake, I think there was another shooting up in Racine, convinced Senator Van Wongard, who is probably, he's a GOP leader in Wisconsin, who is also a former police officer. It convinced him that we needed to do something different. And that's why we created this new board. It's kind of a law enforcement safety board where we take a look at an incident and we try to review it that way and then issue recommendations so it doesn't happen again. So I do think it takes time. I tell everybody it's like steering a battleship. It's really hard to move that nose around in a new direction, but once it goes in that new direction, it's better for everyone.
Michael, thanks for joining us again.
Rob, thank you.
That's Michael Bell. His son, Michael Bell Jr., was shot and killed by a Kenosha police officer in 2004. He's been an advocate for policing reform since then. He was with us today to talk about where those efforts stand now, a year after the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha.